When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I wonder, too, why they omitted Rhaenyra's involvement in settling the dispute. Because in the books, it's just like Daemon gets kind of butthurt, but he essentially just listens. He goes, okay, I'll do what you say, big brother. You did order me on the king.
Well, yeah, I'm looking at all these changes. I'm asking, why did the... Look, I know that the show is now the actual accounting of the facts, but why did they choose to make these the facts?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for all things HBO Max's House of the Dragon. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And we're back with our second installment of Differences Between Fire and Blood and House of the Dragon Season 1. We're going to be covering the events of Season 1, Episode 2, The Rogue Prince. And unlike last week, which had 20-ish pages of source material, we have about two pages to deal with.
Yep.
As far as I can tell, the events of this take place from page 360 in the hardcover to approximately 363. We got like, I think maybe 3.5 pages. Some of the material from this episode was essentially elaboration of stuff we covered last week, like the appointment of Sir Criston Cole to the Kingsguard and some other things like that. But yeah, this is the epitome of Condal and his crew of writers taking mere suggestions and plot points and weaving some compelling TV drama out of it. What do you think of this reading, Jim?
Two things before I let you know what I thought. I think it's incredibly novel, at least for me as somebody who's been producing TV podcasts and movie podcasts for too many years to count now, that you might actually occasionally be able to hear us like leafing through paper on this podcast. Yeah. Which is a weird experience for me, I gotta say. I love it.
Dead tree in it. No Kindle on this podcast.
And the other thing is, I have to ask you, is this pretty typical of a Hot D episode that it matches up to about a page and a half for the book or less? Or is this kind of the anomaly? Are we going to have more material
this
going
is
forward?
Definitely a short assignment.
Okay.
There is more. I imagine there's probably another episode or so that might only be a 3 or 4 pager. But yeah, I mean, it's essentially, if you'd read a synopsis from Wikipedia, it boils down everything to a couple of plot points and then occasionally have some ribald digression into sexual assault and other kinds of stuff at the hands of Mushroom. Yeah, you pretty much have Fire and Blood.
Okay. It'll be interesting going forward.
Some really interesting differences between how the Maesters condense things down 200 years after this history happens and what we see happens, quote unquote, in fact on the show. Because that's position this podcast is, the show is a omniscient camera that saw real life back in Westeros at this time period. And the book is just a Maester doing his best to uncover things from official transcripts and biographies and statements and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, how else could you really do the show and make it dramatically interesting? My big takeaway from the page and a half reading this time is what a really good job they're doing in the show of illustrating everybody's ambition, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like, from Corlys to Otto, I guess those two specifically, Corlys and Otto, they stack a lot of stuff on top of those few mentions in the book where you're led to believe that you know, Corliss just found himself in an inopportune place. He wasn't really like pushing for anything because it wasn't him who brought the suggestion to Viserys to marry Laena. It was just one of the maesters. That it feels like these characters are more real and alive, and they have inner workings in the book or in the show.
Yeah, I think Condal and the other writers really kind of epitomize reading between the lines. You know, they see like, okay, here's a bare account mm-hmm. of what happened, but we know Corliss is ambitious. We know he feels slighted. We know that there's a breach between, you're right, it breathes humanity. You know, a lot of times when you're reading history books about the Civil War or World War II or whatever conflict, you know, you have these essentially characters like Ulysses Grant and General Sherman and, you know, and later, you know, you got the Patton and Eisenhower, and they're these larger than life people that don't, you know, they don't eat. They don't take shits. Uh-huh. They don't get the runs ever or stuff. But like they are human. And I think this is a great. This is such a, and that's why I'm so impressed with this project, is they took something like, you know, 3.5 pages of very, I wouldn't even call it prose. It's just a description of what happened, and mm-hmm. take it and turn it into an hour of compelling television.
Yeah. And then sometimes they're really just kind of inventing things whole cloth, or other times they're adapting bits of this character that might have happened earlier or later and putting them in different context. And I think it's working out really well.
There's a lot of that. There's a couple of things that Damon does in this reading that we'll see depicted later on, because it's apparently just something he does. So,
and Alyssa, yeah, too. The relationship she has with Viserys, I think, is pretty, it's better fleshed out in the show, I would say, than the book. In the book, it feels like Viserys just was walking down a hallway, saw a pretty girl, and said, "That'll be my wife." Mm-hmm. In the show, they've really developed that.
And there's like, you know, there's like a three sentences where the lords of Westeros were kind of murmuring about Otto getting jumped, and maybe he had planned this from the beginning. And but it's just a suggestion, and there's mm-hmm. you know, half the episode is showing that no, Otto did. This wasn't like happenstance. This is something that he engineered and was working in the background to make sure it happened throughout Allison's time in the at court. So I thought those things were really helpful too. And it's very rare that the show just invents things. The obvious example is you know, Aegon's dream and the connection to the Valyrian steel knife. And I guess those came from George himself, discussions with him and Condal. But for the most part, it's just, you know, like they breathe this backstory from Christian Cole, just from the fact that he was born in this certain castle on the borders of Dorne. And you can see Connell's like, you know, what would a knight be doing down there? It's like, you know, we're at, mm-hmm. they're at war with Dorne, and this is a fortress on the border. I bet he fought some skirmish battles and, you know, fought some border wars. And here he is talking about his extensive combat experience. And they take that hint from the book and invent it into a scene where Rhaenyra selects, you know, the book makes it seem like Rhaenyra is this moon-eyed girl who just can't see past how pretty Sir Criston Cole is, and just loved him from the beginning. And there's not that there, because we know he made a big impression on her in the tournament, and mm-hmm. she is young, but this is her being a little head of state. Like, you know, seeing through the political flattery, and this is an important position with the lives of my father and his house in their hands. I need someone who's been tested in battle. So they take these kind of like hints and weave things whole cloth, but it always feels like it could trace back to the books or makes the books better, you know, there's really nothing that Rhaenyra does between becoming appointed as the heir. I mean, there's no hint that Viserys really kind of takes her as anything but as cupbearer. But the show here, like the standoff between her and Daemon, that is invented. But maybe we should get right into it instead of just kind of like haphazardly mentioning. Sure. I do want to go back to last week, because I don't know why I did this. This is at the end of my notes, but there is a couple of things that we're not actually booked to show contradictions. They're just things I wanted to point out. And I got to the end and I forgot to mention it. One of them, which is actually kind of a mystery, is in the books, you've got the Targaryen sigils depicting a two-legged, three-headed red dragon on a field of black. In the show, it's changed from a two-legged dragon to a four-legged dragon. And Condal was actually asked about this early in season one, and he said the reason for the change will be explained later.
Okay.
That's wild, and I haven't a clue. I imagine it's got to be some kind of reference to genealogy or some Targaryen history that'll be... But I thought that was interesting. And the other thing that's different is we see the Godswood in King's Landing, and it's got a weirwood stump. And yeah, in the book, it's an oak tree, because the weirwoods didn't either grow that south, or they had all been cut down and burnt by the Andal invasion. So all the Godswoods south of the neck are essentially counterfeit. They've got them, but they don't have the weirwood. So,
okay.
But yeah, just getting into this discussion here, a lot of the dialogue between characters simply doesn't exist. Like, there's whole scenes, for example, Viserys meeting with Laena in the gardens of King's Landing. Nothing of that. There's no conversation between Rhaenys and Rhaenyra about women's place and being skipped over and stuff like that. That's all invented. There's no scene of Alicent sitting with Viserys and learning about his passion for modeling and all that. But it's great. It's like, I mm-hmm. love the fact that Viserys is a student of history, and how it's portrayed as this extremely nerdy miniature building hobby that he's got, you know, building old Valeria, yeah, the capital of old Valeria.
Well, I think it reinforces what, you know, Rhaenys says about him, that he's not a fool. You know, he could be mistaken for one at times, because he seems like he's maybe a little too complacent, or maybe he's a little too cautious, or takes too much advice and can't make up his own mind. But I think the way he kind of comports himself in this episode and other episodes, the first one included, I don't see him as that. I see him as a guy who's smart, who's trying to keep the realm from destabilizing. And he sees that these things are happening, but he doesn't want to be hasty and react too quickly to them. Mm. Now, I'm kind of with Corlys. I know Corlys is ambitious, and this is directly affecting him, all the stuff that's happening with the crab feeder in this episode. But I think I'm with Viserys here. I wouldn't want to go off half-cocked here and start a war with the Free Cities. I think he's smart not to just go in there with force and take this back. Maybe we'll see more on that later.
And also, it's not probably wise to start a war with Daemon, because
that too,
he's
yeah.
got half the gold cloaks and the dragon, and who knows what would happen. That's the thing. It's interesting that, like, maybe because Viserys is so well educated and preoccupied with history, that, like, he knows too much to be an effective leader. Like, you know, if you're just an idiot and you don't know anything, every single one of your decisions has moral clarity and purpose. You just know you're right. But the more you know, the more you see, oh man, what used to be black and white is now is murky shades of gray. And man, maybe maybe delaying and deferring a decision is the better part. And if you're not watching it right now, Shogun is putting on a master class of a leader whose guiding principle is never make the first move. Yeah. But even Lord Toranaga would probably admit that there is a time where you wait too long. You lose the initiative, and, you know, I think it's interesting, because Viserys, that's, you know, mostly that is any decision you can defer is going to be almost axiomatically better, because you're going to have more information, the situation is going to develop further, but you wait too long and it can bite you in the ass.
And I guess it's the crux of it, right? Knowing when is too long to wait, what threats have to be responded to timely. I don't know. I don't think he's a fool, definitely. And the show does a lot to portray him as not being that.
There are some subtle differences in how the book depicts, because I want to get into Stepstones. You mentioned it, but I also want to set up Daemon so that'll make sense. There's some subtle differences in the way the book talks about Daemon squatting in Dragonstone and the circumstances of Mysterious pregnancy and the dragon egg versus the show. And I wanted to see if you had any thoughts on why the Maesters got it wrong or why the you know, the show kind of differed there.
Yeah, I guess I have to contextualize everything as they got it wrong in the book, right? Because the show is showing us the actual account. Huh.
That's what I think is super interesting is like, why did the Maesters think it this when it was obviously this other thing? And there's lots of answers, you know.
Sure.
What the hell did historians know in another world thousands of years ago? But
That's interesting. I mean, it could be a face-saving thing, I guess, for Daemon. Though neither of these comes off particularly well. But if you think that, it's just a matter of circumstance that he lost a child with Mysteria and not, he lied about all of this stuff in the first place and he was never going to marry her. She never was pregnant. That might save a little face for Daemon.
It's just because like the book, it just seems like Daemon's just being impetuous. You know, he's bored of his wife and the Vale, and you know he's sulking over his hurt feelings about his brother yelling at him for making the ill-timed jape about his son, and he gets her pregnant, and you know does what a Targaryen prince would do, gives her an egg, and the show it seems much more like he's deliberately trying to get his brother's attention.
Yes.
Like, look at me, yeah. Big brother, look at me. Like, I'm going to squat on Dragonstone and I'm not the heir. Rhaenyra should be here, but I'm here and nothing happens. I'm taking a whore to my bed, taking a second wife, nothing happens. And the crucial thing that really clicked for me when I was watching this episode is he stole an egg from the dragon pit when Dragonstone is lousy with dragons and clutches of dragon eggs. The only reason he would sneak back home and steal an egg is to deliberately, you know, and if that didn't work, he would have kept on doing it. I don't know if he'd eventually invaded King's Landing to try to get his attention, but he just kind of, and I think the show as a whole paints this even, the Daemon just wants to be seen and loved by his family, but he's an asshole. He's an impulsive asshole, so his attempts at that always come out like some hyperactive child who is jealous that a teacher's giving someone else their attention, you know, so I'm gonna go
right. And I do think that's why, you know, Corlys is they call it a war council in the book. It doesn't feel like that in the show. It feels like, you know, they're just both trying to stir shit to make opportunities for them so that maybe they can get back in the seat they just lost. But yeah, it makes sense why he would maybe go along with Corlys' plan, because he's seeking that attention, right? I don't know if he's exactly aligned with Corlys, because Corlys seems to be the guy who feels like he has earned something bigger, and he keeps getting passed over. And both the book and the show make that point pretty clear. But then Daemon doesn't feel quite like that. There's something different about it. Maybe it's the impetuousness. Maybe it's the, like, there's a real jealousy that comes through there. With Corlys, it doesn't feel like jealousy. It just feels like, it's my time, damn it. I've earned this.
Yeah. Whereas Daemon just, like, came from the womb restless. Like, if you analyze all the choices he makes in the series, you can almost reliably decide what he's going to do by what is the more exciting option. You know, is it more exciting to stay at home with the bronze bitch, or is it more exciting to go sail with Corlys and murder a bunch of dudes on the stepstones with my dragon? Gonna do the latter every time.
It gives him an opportunity to be seen.
And I think that's interesting that the Maesters miss that, you know, that they just report the deception, which was, I got my wife pregnant and I'm presenting her with an egg as a fact, and completely miss the subtlety of the king and his relationship. They also, you know, I'm assuming that everyone has seen all of House of the Dragon, or at least through season one at this point. They also miss a detail where because they, and this is another interesting thing, they say because of Mysteria, he sent her back over to Lys. She had a difficult passage and miscarried the child on board. We know none of that is true. Mm-hmm. But they say that's the thing that set Daemon and Viserys against each other. And I wonder if that's because, you know, we see that there's this push and pull through them, and there's true love and unity to surprisingly late in the season. Family love. Why did the is this just the easiest explanation? They're looking through all the things that eventually happened in Dance of Dragons and the rest of Viserys' life, and it's like, miscarried his first son. That'll do it.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, it's certainly a bigger. I don't know. Maybe it's just that's the straw that broke the camel's back, right? Like they say, mm-hmm. He got sent away, he got shuffled around all these different jobs, and he was never appreciated, and now this is the straw that breaks the camel's back.
I wonder too why they omitted Rhaenyra's involvement in settling the dispute, because in the books it's just like Daemon gets kind of butt hurt, but he essentially just listens. He goes, okay, I'll do what you say, big brother. You did order me, I'm the king, or you're the king. And this we see that Daemon's going to shed blood until Rhaenyra showed up and be like, hey, I'm the one you're really mad at. Kill me.
I'm looking at all these changes. I'm asking, why did the... Look, I know that the show is now the actual accounting of the facts, but why do they choose to make these the facts? The Rhaenyra shows up and backs down Daemon. I think that's to strengthen the bond that they have, right? Show how much deference he shows to her, how much he cares about her. He would never hurt her, I don't think. He wouldn't. Like, he could easily kill Otto, but once she steps in, that really shows the audience, like, oh, he just can't hurt his niece here. And then the other fact might be, well, maybe there were just too many dead babies in the early goings of this show. Like, we can't have another miscarriage on a boat. That's just
too much. Oh my God. That's actually a meta analysis, but it does track, because there was a lot of weirdness at the sheer amount of childbirth trauma in the first season of this.
Yeah, and we've got plenty more coming up. So,
but it does really create an interesting dilemma, because the book has got all this, you know, the Daemon doted over Rhaenyra, that Rhaenyra took a shine to him, and they had this kind of special relationship. Yeah, yeah. But like, this really puts him in the horns of the dilemma, because what he wants most is to be seen by his brother, to be named the heir. But now the thing that, you know, he kind of delights in, the member of the family that kind of doesn't shun him, that thinks he's cool, is the thing that stands in the way of his ambitions. So even for, like, that's the one thing that might set a guy like, you know, Daemon on his heels, because what do I want here? What is the more exciting option? it's tough. But I also think in the show, not only does it show the relationship between Daemon and Rhaenyra, but it also gives Rhaenyra something to do other than hold her father's cups and make moon eyes over Cole, you know.
Shows that she might actually be a good leader in the future.
Yeah, that she's bold, she takes an initiative, that she can cut through the surface stories and get to what's really motivating people. For sure. Like I said, this episode deals with a lot of the changes we discussed earlier. The Lord Commander dies, the promotion of Sir Harold to the Lord Commander, the need of replacement. I think it was, like I said, I really like how they took that and gave him this Dornish backstory and his military career that doesn't exist in the books, but is very, very easy to understand from book to the screen. But they also suggest this brings us to the marriage alliance proposals. You're right. The book makes it seem as if this Laena was the Maester's, all of his advisors' number one choice, except for probably Otto. But in the show, they have Corlys make that offer himself.
Yeah, with Rhaenys, which I think helps. I think that helps his case here. I think it's pretty naked power grab, I guess, by Corlys here. And I don't know if that's part of what goes into Viserys' decision not to accept it. But yeah, it seems a little more blatant than what they do in the book, which is somebody just goes, the Grand Maester Runciter goes to Viserys and says, hey, maybe you should marry Laena. Now, I have to think in the background, even in the book, that the Corlys had something to do with that, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting.
Although he's not on the small council at that point. Is that right?
Right. He rage quits it after the great council, essentially.
So maybe he wouldn't.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's another thing that the Maesters got. I mean, obviously they got wrong, but like that seems like a pretty big thing to fuck up. Someone resigning as the Lord Admiral.
I mean, it's, if we go with the show as fact, it's demonstrably true. But I don't know how you would. Yeah. No, that's.
But also could be like, you know, depending on his conduct during the Dance of the Dragons, maybe it's something that the Maesters, you know, I could see, like, you know, if you're recounting World War One history from 100 years, 200 years from hence, which is much in the future, and some field marshal got demoted for some reason, and then a year later got remoted because, you know, whatever kind of political thing resolved, like, you know, if you're just telling the tale of that at a 10,000 foot view, do you even go into that, or is he just the high marshal that was the high marshal throughout the war and end up winning for it? But it's like I can see them making, because again, all of this episode is condensed into barely 3 pages of text, so
yeah, it's just smoothing out the bumps of history, right?
Yeah, it could be. There's also interesting a mistake, but Condal claims it's deliberate, that throughout this episode, Corlys brags about Targaryen and Valyrian being the two great surviving Valyrian houses. But in fact, in the books, there is House Keltigar.
What?
That's also another Westerosi house that has Valyrian ancestry. And Ryan Condal was asked about this during season one of House of Dragon, and he says, I am aware, but this is a part of the characterization of Corlys, that he's deliberately slighting this minor house and puffing his own importance up by saying,
sure,
the Celtigar, who are they? Fuck them. Like, you know, do they even have silver hair at this point? That he's, you know, essentially overstating his case, which is, you know, kind of befits, I think, his Han Solo-ish stature. In the books, he's kind of a much more serious, sober character on the series, a lot more gravitas, where he's, you know, much more kind of given to flights of passion and restlessness, and he's a lot more Daemonish in the books. I think that's interesting. Apparently Celtigars are going to show up later in the show, according to Condal, so we shall see.
One of the other sort of little details, I guess, about this marriage proposal is the line that Laena says when, you know, she's nervous about being with the king here and potentially being his bride, and he asks her what her mother said to her about this. She says, I won't have to bed you until I turn 14. And it's interesting because this is like the Amma situation in the books, right? Where they were kind of young, and I know Viserys was a lot younger, the age gap wasn't there, but like in the book,
Viserys
she was
even
too young
at this time in the books, where he's clearly
right
on the wrong side of 30.
Man.
Yeah
like me. But Amma is the young one, right, who has to wait for the bedding stuff until she comes of age. That was interesting. I didn't know if maybe that was also a thing that they did with Laena in the book, but yeah, in the show here, they seem to have transposed those characteristics.
Yeah, it's very interesting that, like, I find that a lot of times, and this went for Game of Thrones too, that characters are aged up and aged down in order not to squick our modern sensibilities out, like seeing a 45-year-old,
it's still weird and gross.
Well, but Viserys plays it as visibly discomforted,
sure,
and like,
yeah,
I just can't marry 12-year-old guys. I don't care what you say. I don't care if I have to wait till 40. This is just fucking weird.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously that wouldn't happen in Westeros, but But in this case, they left her 12. Condal in an interview said that they did that deliberately so our audience's feelings of this is fucked up and wrong match Viserys's feelings is fucked up and wrong, and it makes us kind of somewhat relieved when he chooses Alicent, who is old enough, and but also kind of it's another way to get the audience to kind of like, you know, feel comfortable with an uncomfortable situation.
And they may have picked a particularly young looking 12-year-old, I would say. Doesn't read as 12 to me, but
yes. Yeah. But it's tough because it's very child beauty pageant, right? She's in this exquisite gown and her hair is all made up with this big mop of white, and she's made up and all that. I thought it's also like you can see why all the advisors were hot for this deal, because not only would it seal this rift that's kind of been growing between Valyrian, which again, Westeros depends on, more than half their fleet is Corlys's fleet. Gets these two ambitious houses to kind of make up. Not only is, you know, her lineage and peerage and all that stuff impeccable, but there's also some kind of soft things going at work here. For example, the last rider of Valyrian, the Black Dread, Aegon's personal mount, was Viserys. He only rode it a couple of circles around King's Landing, but he did ride it. And Laena here, they tell us, is mastered Vhagar, which is Aegon's queen Visenya's mount. So it's like, you can really see the lords being like, oh man, we can see Aegon return. It's the king with his lady wife, and she's a dragon rider, and she's got the old queens. Like, there's a lot of this synergy, and we find out later in House of Dragon how important that symbology is, not only to the lords and ladies, but to the small folk. To, like, you know, a person with the Aegon's crown and holding Blackfyre, that's the fucking king, no matter what anybody says. Like, he's got all the king stuff. He's in the king's city, sitting on the king's seat. I don't know who this queen in Dragonstone says she is, but it's a political kind of coup. But Viserys says, nah. And he chooses Alicent, which the book described had caught his eye. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to Hot D.
Yeah, before we move to Allison, I still want to talk a little bit more about Lena, because there's sure. also the idea that there's a delay here, right? I mean, there's always going to be a delay between the time you get married and the time your first male heir pops out, right? With Lena, it's a little bit longer, though, because they're going to have to wait 2 years to even consummate this marriage, and then you're going to have to wait another 9 months for a kid, at least. Is there any pressure on the council to kind of push him towards somebody who might be a little bit older and ready to bear him a child? Because, look, in this time period or in this setting, 3 years is not that long of a time. Like, if you're going to fight a war, it might take you 3 years to get together the forces you need just by, you know, taking your freaking horse across the country to go talk to one of the lords to see if you can get support for it. You know, I don't think things would destabilize quite that fast, but it is probably.
But you also
concern.
Never know, like, if, sure. you know, he gets
he's
fucking
sticking his hand into maggots because his flesh is rotting off. So you never
right.
know.
Right. And the other thing is, that's another change from the book to the show, because the book, it makes it describes Lena as a fiery young maiden, freshly flowered. So at 12 years old, she's ready to sire kids. And I think this 14-year-old is another sop to our sensibilities that, like, it kind of makes Renice not like, you know, she's not offering her 12-year-old daughter. She's potentially offering up her future 14 more mature daughter.
Whereas
in the books, it's implied that that'd go right to the bedding ceremony.
So I don't know. That's a slight wrinkle. But yeah, now we can talk about Alicent and his choice.
Yeah. Like, again, in the book, it says that he kind of took a fancy after her and she caught his eye. But the show makes it clear what the book only hints at, which was he caught her eye because Otto wouldn't let his eye fall on anything else. Go to the king. Tell him how cool his hobbies are. He broke his dragon. Fix his dragon. Give it to
him.
Wear your mom's. Wear your mom's dress. The hot one. When you go to It's all like engineered because of Otto's first. I mean, there's two purposes. He's an ambitious man, and also he is scared shitless of King Daemon and what that would mean for him, his family, and the realm. So,
I think it's a super solid change. I think, like, showing having it not be, oh, this is the girl who used to read to King Jaehaerys, and I've heard of her, and I saw her in the hall, and I like her, let's get married. Here, they spend the time to develop a real relationship. You know, they take that and they transpose it onto Viserys, so now she's reading to him of these history books. I think that's a super smart change, because who cares what happened, you know, 10 years ago or whatever with Jaehaerys. It's all about these characters and taking that and adding that to Alicent and this Viserys's relationship makes it almost a reasonable choice, right? It tells us that he's doing this because he has genuine affection for Alicent, as opposed to, well, I need a wife and Alicent's pretty, so let's go.
And also the other thing I think that helps it from our modern sensibilities angle is that Viserys doesn't want to do any of this. Like, he's got his heir. As far as he's concerned, that's fine. It's his advisors. And the book and the show agree on that his advisors are the one that's like, hey, I'm glad we got your heir thing sorted out. But, you know, you're awful young. You could still marry. Who knows? You could pop out a son. That's not impossible. It's been known to happen before. So it's like, you know, he's being forced by the girl's father and his entire small council wants him to remarry because, you know, it's also another chip into strengthening alliances and whatnot, which is that's another reason why Alicent's such a misplay. You know, her father's already handed the king the second highest ranking person in the realm. Like, what does a marriage alliance do between the Hightowers and the Targaryens? But, like, I think Viserys really sees this as the best of all bad options that he doesn't really want to go through.
And I think, you know, with the death of Amma and the sort of nature that they showed of their relationship, Viserys and her, I think he's looking for something akin to that, right? Not something where he's just going to marry and not know the person and, you know, not have anything, like, not have a real relationship. He kind of wants a real relationship, and that has been developing because of Otto over the last six months with Allison.
I wonder what, I mean, that's the thing is, like, I wonder what he would do if he knew that Allison was only doing this to be, and she was very uncomfortable. You can tell by the way she bites her nails and struggles not to, that this whole situation's making her very uncomfortable. She's just doing this to please her father. But I don't think that Viserys picks up on this. Like, he just sees this as a young girl being earnestly interested in him, and, oh, wow, she's interested in history, and she's pretty good looking, and it'd certainly make Otto happy, so why not? Mushroom had some disgusting commentary about Allison Hightower.
Sure.
So is it calumny? Is the sin being described here is essentially old-timey slander and gossip? Almost profane false statements made about someone. Not only does he accuse Viserys of dipping into the water well before the marriage, but he goes back to this was happening with Alicent reading to the old king too. It was more than just innocent reading sessions. I it seems, if this is the omniscient point of view, that Mushroom's at least full of shit about Viserys, probably full of shit about the old king too.
I mean, yeah, I look, she's supposed to be 18, is that right?
Yeah, in the show, she's 18 in the show, and I think also 18 she's 18 in the book, and I think she's more like 14 or maybe 12 13 14 in the show.
Okay, so she couldn't have been sent to Jaehaerys's chambers to comfort him as he was dying in the show. She's way too young. And there's certainly no reading happening, and certainly no mushrooming happening.
Yeah. So for keeping score at home, that's a demerit for Mushroom. The other thing is we see Daemon beating to death the messenger who sent the word of his brother's engagement, which we'll later see him do to one of his soldiers in a later episode. So it's another one of the things where they took a moment from one instance and just generalize it that, you know what, Daemon probably does this. He's probably not the guy you want to give bad news to. He's definitely do kill the messenger kind of guy. So I thought that was interesting. Another detail that I'm glad they omitted, but also I kind of maybe they should have, is that at Viserys and Alicent's wedding, that Rhaenyra was one of the participants in the betting ceremony, which, if you don't know, in Westeros, after everyone gets married, all the groomsmen and the bridesmaids and the people, they grab the husband, the newly betrothed, and they carry him to their bedchambers as they rip their clothes off and they throw him in there naked and watch him fuck. This is to make sure that the marriage is consummated. Yeah, Rhaenyra participating in that, I could see, like, or and like, if the show had showed it kind of like something she didn't really want to do, but she had to, it's like I could see that starting a rift between her and Allison all by itself. Like, I saw my dad bone you, dude. Not cool.
Yeah, we were hanging out next to the Weirwood yesterday. Today you're getting down with my dad. It's weird.
Yeah. The book and the show are also in agreement that Daemon appears to channel his frustrations with what's going on at court into Corlys's offer of an alliance.
Yeah.
Cause anything is better at cooling his heel than cooling his heels and in the Vale with his bronze bitch. He says Dark Sister is meant for better things than slaughtering sheep. And they do go, the one thing they do, and this is half the account, is the backstory for the Stepstones, which I think is interesting. It's crucial to really understand the military situation that's depicted in the show. Is the Stepstones, if you didn't know, is this chain of islands that connects Dorne to the eastern shore of Westeros with the western shore of Essos. That's kind of confusing. And in mythical terms, this used to be a land bridge, and that was the way that the first men crossed, very analogous to the Bering Strait kind of theory for how North America, the Americas, got populated. And then during the war between the First Men and the Children, one of their earliest gambits was to the Children to shatter that land bridge, which left the Stepstones. And in this time, around 100 AC, because of its status as between these two great powers, you got Westeros on one end and Essos on the other, that these island chains have been this disputed territory where it's kind of no man's land and a haunt for outlaws and pirates. But they were never organized. They were kind of working their own things and are kind of at war at each other. So merchants, the reason that's important is if you want to do business with Dorne or the western shore of Westeros, which contains such wealthy ports such as Lannisport, which is controlled by the Lannisters, Old Town, you would have to sail through the Stepstones, and that's where the pirates would get you. And apparently, while these pirates are kind of disorganized, kind of riffraff, it was seen as like a nuisance. But at 10 years before the time of the show, these three independent cities in Essos, it was Lys, Myr, and Tyrosh, allied against Volantis, which had kind of controlled their half of the Stepstones, and beat them up. And as an armistice consideration, Volantis gave up control of the Stepstones, which allowed the three daughters, as they called themselves, because each free city in Essos claims directly descendant from Old Valyria. So they're the daughters of Old Valyria. The three daughters quickly take control of the Stepstones. And initially, everyone in Westeros is like, cool, we don't have to deal with pirates anymore. We got heads of state to deal with. But to recoup some of the costs of their war, the three daughters started charging tolls to get through the Stepstones. And at first they were reasonable, but it's eventually got to the point where the merchants were evading the three daughters' ships like they were to pirates because they just couldn't afford it. Plus, some of the free cities were pressing the young boys and girls out of these ships, turning them into prostitutes at brothels. Even one of the firstborn daughters of one of the minor houses got this to happen to him. So you can imagine, we just mentioned that Corlys owns 50% of the ships in Westeros. Who's going to be the one that suffers the most with this change in the Stepstone? Well, it's Corlys. And the other, like, there's also the hint that maybe the other lords don't really care because they don't mind Corlys getting taken down a peg or two or three. So his pleas to kind of clean this up are fall on deaf ears. Plus, he's in books, he's not even on a small council. And that's where he comes up with this idea to propose an alliance between him and Daemon. I'll do the fleet stuff. You do the army stuff with your dragons, and we'll split the gold and glory amongst ourselves. So, apparently this crab feeder was this Moorish prince that rose up to kind of like lead the campaign against the Stepstones. There's not much mentioned of him other than he got the name Crabbeater because when he captured these pirates, he would stake them out so that they would get drowned and get eaten by the crabs. We see that graphically illustrated. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing in the books that suggests that he has grayscale or wears this mask or anything like that. That's just done to sex up the show, which I don't mind. It's visually cool. I think that's all the kind of backstory. And again, that's the last page and a half of the material for today. Did you have anything that you wanted to bring to the table?
No, I think that's about it.
All right. Once again, if you'd like to send us feedback during our look back between the books and the show, it's easy to do so. hotd@baldmove.com is how you send in that feedback. You can follow us at all social medias @baldmove. And then if you'd like to support what we're doing here, help us continue to make podcasts, keep the bits flowing and the lights on here at Bald Move, support.baldmove.com, and get ad-free feeds and a ton of other extra bonus audio content. Thanks for joining us at our look at Fire and Blood and House of the Dragon. We'll be back to discuss the events of the third episode next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.